Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
How's it going, friends? Welcome to Someone Who Isn't Me, episode 19. Now, it has been a minute since the last episode, but that episode with Dan Searle from Architects was such a heavy one, an important one, that I thought it would be good to just let it sit for a while. And a lot of people discovered the podcast through that one, and they've since gone back and listened to a bunch of the other ones as well, and it seems that they've really enjoyed it, which is a beautiful thing. So it has been a minute, so I'm officially calling this season two. And it's a really strong one to start with. It's with James Lavelle of Uncle. He's also the man that founded Mowax, which was an incredible label. He started it when he was 18, which is actually nuts when I think about all the things that that label put out and all that it achieved. He played a key role in so much culture in the UK, especially through like street art and also like street style, like things like Bathing Ape and Supreme and Stussy. And he played a key role in the early days of all those brands here in the UK. So we kind of touch on that a little bit, but we also discuss the brand new album from Uncle, which comes out August 18th. It's called The Road Part 1. It's amazing. Since we did this, I actually got a copy of the CD, and I like to listen to stuff in my car, and it's testament to how great an album is and how much is going on with it if it just stays in the CD player and nothing else gets a look in for like a couple of weeks, because all I'm listening to when I'm driving is that. It's incredible. It's a brilliant piece of work. So we discuss a bit about that album. We also talk a little bit about the documentary called The Man from Mowax, which I got a link to before doing the interview as well. So whilst I was listening to the album for the first few listens, I was then going back and watching the documentary as well. And so for me, they kind of ran in tandem, and I was experiencing them both at the same time. And I kind of gave that as my viewpoint for the start of this, as you'll hear. But we talk about all these things, and also how an artist that was predominantly known for being within the dance and electronica community transitioned over the years into the rock community through people like Ian Asprey and Josh Homme and Tom York and Chris Goss and Geordie White. So we talk about all those things as well. You know, this is a guy that came into that world and ended up, like, he produced the last Queens of the Stone Age record, and Like Clockwork is my favourite album of theirs as well. It took me a minute, but again, such an incredible piece of work. So we discuss all those things. It was an incredible afternoon hanging out with him. We were recorded it, and we were just surrounded by all these treasures, like incredible paintings and sculptures and all these books and stuff all about this culture, which is, I find, so exciting and is so vibrant. So yeah, it was a brilliant afternoon. I hope you enjoy this one. I'm really chuffed with it, and I know that he really enjoyed it as well. So yeah, this is James Lavelle. I got sent a stream of the album, so the thing that I struggle with a little bit, I understand the way things are now, because you just can't send things out in advance the way it is, so that someone can drive around with it in their car and look at it. Yeah. But
Twiggy texted me the same thing last night.
Oh, really?
He said, I love the album, but I really just want to listen to it in my car.
Yeah, there you go. It's a funny thing. Like, I get it. I'm not. Thanks. Well, the thing is for me is like it's clearly so dense. There's so much going on with it, but then I think that's the way everything is that you've done.
Yeah,
and like I've watched the documentary as well. But it almost feels like that they sit together.
Yeah.
Because with the way the album starts with the with the quote of,
yeah,
you know, yeah, this looking back at your life, I won't even try and quote it word,
yeah,
for word,
because I can't even remember the exact words, but yeah, it's
saying that essentially you're looking back and this is the journey that you've traveled,
yeah,
right,
yeah,
which is where, yeah, the album title comes from, I presume,
yeah,
because it's so evocative, isn't it? Before I even listened to it, you see the title, it made me think, okay, is this, that's obviously referencing a journey, and I wasn't sure at what point of the journey
it's a metaphor for different journeys. So there's the past,
yeah,
and there's now, and there's the future,
yeah,
and the road being this thing that you're kind of constantly on this journey through life, but also it's this thing that the record and the way that a lot of the recordings are taken and had been created were just being on this sort of finding yourselves in different places over a period of time, and that then culminating into a record.
Yeah,
you know, so this record was recorded in Venice in Italy, Naples in Italy, Somerset, London, LA, Berlin, and so those sort of, and you know, and then, and also through that process was, I'd split up with the last incarnation uncle, which was very difficult and very soul destroying, and I found myself very lost for a while, and then how I started to re-engage my creative life, and that there was a sort of backseat on doing Uncle, and I was working more with artists and doing sort of collaborations, sort of weird music art collaborations,
yeah,
and I ended up in places like Cuba, and you know, going to weird shows all over the world with this sort of new group of people that I'd started working with, and a lot of those people were in the Kubrick exhibition, have now contributed artwork to the label, and it was, the road just came from this thing of, yeah, taking all these experiences and making that into something, and in a kind of positive way, making something out of that work and that journey, but also the thing of it being this road that one's had, and reflecting on the past and what music meant to you, and yeah, where you've been, and you know, there was during this process, there's been quite a lot of retrospective things that have gone on. So you've had Meltdown, you had I did a MOAX exhibition at Saatchi, I did the MOAX book, the documentary, and so there was a lot of stuff dealing with the past, and that was, it was cathartic, but it was painful as well. It was good, it was bad, it was, you know, the documentary, I didn't direct it, I didn't produce it, I creatively supported it, and I wanted to make something, I wanted it to be hopefully something that was good. I didn't realise it was going to be so hardcore.
Yeah, it's pretty unflinching.
Yeah, and that was hard, but I took a view that we live in a world now where, you know, if you get a musician's documentary, it tends to be produced or directed by them, and it's all nice and everything looks great. And actually, this has been part of the journey. I think there are, you know, the director, the producers have their agenda, and they want to make it into this kind of good versus evil, big, you know, the highs, the lows, da da da. And there's a lot of stuff in there that I don't think was shown that I would have liked to have, but they didn't feel that was the story they wanted to tell.
Yeah, of course.
You know,
yeah,
and there's quite a few people in there. It gets a little. The one thing that annoys me a little bit is that they sort of paint this picture of me constantly not having long-term relationships, and yet there's about five or six really key people that there's not in the documentary that are interviewed that I've been friends with for 25 years from day one, or somebody like Ben Drury, who's in it for 2 seconds, who designed MOAX, who I've worked with since we were 18, or you know, my best friend that helped work on this record that I've been friends since I was 14, but they came much more at it from the sort of DJ shadow angle, you know. But I sort of just let it be what it was, and I think that I definitely have had a few freakouts about it, and I have a very good manager who manages Nick Cave, and Brian, you know, Brian Message, who's, you know, he works with Radiohead and Nick and PJ Harvey, and he said, you know, acts that have not always had the easiest journey and are not really acts that should be polished. And the thing about, he was talking about Nick and saying, look, you know, until I worked with Nick, Nick didn't know anything about his business, his career. It was just this constant sort of snowball getting bigger and bigger. And then we stopped and we're like, you need to just look at these things and then how you build, rebuild again. And in many ways, he sort of compared, I'm not comparing myself to Nick, who I think is amazing and one of the greatest artists in this country right now.
Yeah.
But I think he was saying that, look, you know, at the end of the day, like, just show it, try and be okay to let it go out there and show people that you have constantly tried. And, you know, he's like, he said something funny like, I've had 3 successes in my life, and yet I've managed, you know, 1,000 artists. They just happen to be great successes. Nick Cave, Radiohead, and something else, you know. And he's like, you know, I think that, you know, all you've tried to do is what the artists that I think are important have done, which is you keep trying and pushing. And it is difficult, but it's not about showing, it's not about being perfect, because everything is perfect. Instagram is perfect. Every photo is perfect. And there's none of the dust, the stuff that goes with it. And actually that's
the reality.
That's the reality, you know.
Yeah.
So I think that I let that go, and I'm sort of, I look at it as a kind of bookend to a period of my life, you know.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, there are people in there that I fell out with. There are people that I really love that I hurt, and I think people have to remember that I was very, very young when I did what I did. The record industry was very different. I wasn't particularly protected. I ran a record company and was an artist, but I wasn't very understood particularly. Mm. And in retrospect now, it's amazing that people can come and look at the Toys and Supreme and Bathing Ape and, you know, this world around the music and the artwork and everything. But at the time, it was, you know, there's an interesting quote from one of the Enemy journalists at the time, Science Fiction, going, you know, I can't believe that the owner of the record labels made this album, and it just feels so contrived. And you're like, you know, I look at now and it's like, well, Richard Russell's making records, you know, Kanye, everything, the way that the modern model of making records is very different. And I just think that there was a time that I wasn't very understood, and it had quite a detrimental effect to how I dealt with my childhood, because I didn't really have a childhood.
Yeah.
I was 18 when I had my wax. I'd been DJing before that. I was 21 when it all kicked off, and I was 27 when it finished. Hmm. You know, my wax. And then, you know, and also the record industry was this amazing place where, you know, you think about when we were kids, you would be at school, and when you were like 14, they're like, okay, you're going to do work experience, and you can either be work in the service industry, or you can go be a lawyer or an accountant, or if you're lucky, maybe you can go be an artist and go to the Ruskin or go to St. Martin's, but a real Picasso painter, you know. And the idea of what I did was just not understood. But when you got into that world, it was like you'd gone into Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah.
And it was like, here you go, here's a load of money, and you can do whatever you like. And guess what? We're going to encourage it.
Yeah.
And if you know, look at all this white powder, and look at all these sweets, you know, it's like the Adam's apple thing. And you take a bite of the apple, and 20 years later, you're sitting there going, what the fuck was that about? You know? Yeah.
Well, it's an incredible thing, isn't it? I think that's, unfortunately, that seems to be the lot of somebody that's an innovator.
Yeah.
In a sense, because, I mean, you look back at all the achievements that you did and are continuing to do, and I think, you know, you were innovating on all those things. And I think it's interesting, because it would be such a different... Or would it? I don't know whether it would be different if it was somebody of that age in the situation in this current world that we find ourselves in. Would we even be in that world if people hadn't forged ahead with all different aspects?
No, you wouldn't, because, you know, Kanye and Pharrell and all that, what I think, who are the precursors, who are the modern, the way that really this, what I created, I'm talking about the world outside of music.
Yeah.
They got that from my community, you know. It came from them going to Japan and meeting Nico from Bathing Ape.
Yeah.
That's how that started for them. And I was a person that had worked with Nego for 10 years before that.
Yeah.
But it also existed when there was no internet.
Of course.
So you couldn't buy the stuff anywhere. You couldn't see it anywhere, apart from if you opened the Face or ID, or, you know, or were hanging out in the clubs.
Hmm.
You know, and also I think I think for me, my journey, I came from acid house and hip hop. There was, the rave culture, there was a drug culture, very hedonistic culture, and it was DJ culture. And that was that was the core of where everything came from discovering whether it was sneakers or t-shirts or girls, drugs, music, record, everything. That was the center point. And I was very young, and I think that maybe if I'd understood what I had, and if I had maybe be a little bit more patient and also not throw myself so far into places, I would have had a different type of career. But then again, if I hadn't, I don't know if it would have happened.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I know.
Because people didn't come to me, I went to them.
Yeah.
I wasn't the cool kid. Everybody now goes, oh, you were so cool then. It was like, I wasn't, at the time, I wasn't the cool kid. I wanted to be. There were people around me that they were the cool ones, the Massive Attacks and the Michael Kopperman that ran Gimme Five that did Stussy, or Ronin, who were like the DJ, the cool DJs or whatever. I was 10 years younger than them. And so I was sort of 21, 22, 23, trying to run this business, this situation where most of your friends are your age, you've got a load of money, they don't. You're not thinking about buying houses, you're thinking about buying things that related to you. So it was kind of sneakers and toys and paint, street art and whatever. But the industry didn't understand it. So when I was doing Mowax and I did Mowax Arts and we're trying to do toy stuff, it's all great now that it's brilliant now that you can do retrospectives and show stuff like that, but nobody bought it. People weren't buying into that. They didn't really buy into it until Pharrell and Kanye started doing it. And at that point, I had kind of
cleared the path,
and I'd also kind of I reacted against it. I didn't. The thing is, I remember there was a point where things were going difficult for me. I lost Mowax. That had a massive financial domino effect on my life. And I was privileged for 5 or 6 years where I did live a different life. And then the rug gets pulled under your feet, and you're still having to accommodate that life because when you've got a mortgage or all the things you've got to pay, and the domino effect happens. And suddenly you're sort of going. I remember going to Japan and seeing Nigo, and he had a platinum diamond chain, and it was £1 million. And I just looked at it, and I was like, I'm not part of this. And it's like, and it all sort of went that way. And to me, it was like, this isn't my thing. I wouldn't wear £1 million around my neck,
Yeah, but then
it's hard to explain. I don't mean it in that way, but you know what I mean? It wasn't bling for me. It was what we were doing when we started all that. It was a very teenage thing. We'd grown up on Star Wars. We'd grown up on hip hop, the Wild Bunch, Massive Attack, Public Enemy, Def Jam, da da da, and we just wanted to do those things.
Yeah.
We wanted to do Stussy, so just screen printing a T-shirt was like the most amazing thing ever. And then you do that, and then that would sell, and then you go, wouldn't it be amazing if we could make a toy? And it was because of Japan. It was like we met the best toy company, which was Medicom, and went in there and made toys. But you weren't thinking of it as an industry. It was in the same way that when I started doing Mowax, a lot of the time, to be honest with you, the records I was doing was just to outdo my mates.
Yeah.
It was to go to Bar Rumba and play a record that Giles Peterson didn't have.
Yeah.
Or to tell my friend Will Bankhead that, he'd be like, oh, did you hear that Richie Horton record? I'd be like, yeah, I'll get a remix. No, you won't. I was like, next week I'll be like, I got a remix. And it was just this office of nerdy kids just kind of like out, I just wanted to just try and do the coolest shit and sort of, but it was really about them. That was my world. There was no internet. There was no stats. There was no like, oh, if you do that, you're going to get this. And it was very, very sort of, it was quite, it was a lot of it, I was 18, so I was closer to my teen, I was still a teenager, So the references were very of that time, and it was, Star Wars and the Beastie Boys and Massive Attack and Futura and New York Graffiti and all those things. And that's what I threw myself into. But I was very young and I didn't really I didn't really know how to manage it, you know.
Yeah, I don't think anyone knows how to manage anything at that age.
No.
To be fair.
I mean, I'm 27. When I was 27, it was funny because my ex, my daughter's mother, who I also met when I was 21, and she was 10 years older than me, and I had my daughter when I was 23. Mm. And so she was 33 when she had her, or a bit younger. She was 8 years older than me, so she was 31. It was a big difference, you know, and you're like at the height of everything. And, you know, and it was incredibly exciting and hedonistic and everything was coming together. And I think that club culture has changed quite a lot now, but club culture was the core of everything. It's where you socialise. You didn't, you know, it's everything to, you know, Bar Rumba on a Monday night or the Blue Note. That is where you met everybody. That was, you know, you know, it was even, you know, half people didn't even have mobile phones half the time then, you know. It was all just starting to happen. And so you had to go to the club to hang out, you know, and that's where you'd hear the records and see the fashion and everything. And you know, but my, you know, she was older and she was like, had she done all that? So she was going to bed at 10 o'clock and you're starting to DJ at 3 a.m. And it was just, everything was a bit off kilter. And I remember a couple of years ago, she said to me, oh, you know, ASAP Rocky is so great, he's so young. And I'm like, he's 28. I was finished. It was all done by the time I was his age. Everything had finished, you know. I was like, fuck, I was young too.
Yeah.
you know.
Once. Yeah, it's crazy. I mean.
But also, there are things that one has lost, but there's a lot I've gained. I'm proud of what I was involved in, what I did, and I think more now. I definitely, sort of in my 30s, I kind of turned my back on a lot of the past. I really was just like, I don't want to deal with Mowax, I don't want to deal with, you know, all the street stuff so much. I did a clothing label called Surrender. I got more sort of rock and roll inspired because everything that I'd been involved with, I just saw suddenly become this commercial entity. It's like suddenly it's a, you know, Chanel bear brick and Bathing Apes collaborating with everything, and you're like, you know, and you wanted a sense of your own identity, your own world. And so I kind of went off and in many ways that was my sort of my journey with meeting people like Josh Homme and stuff like that, because that world suddenly was like, okay, that's somewhere I'm going into a new place where,
yeah,
they understand where I'm at in my life, and everybody else is over there. I've discovered something new, you know. Yeah. And so I did, you know, that's when I did things like War Stories, and I did Surrender. And Surrender, it was more of it was a kind of, in a weird way, it was my kind of my having to move away from that period. But then life eventually comes full circle.
Yeah.
And I think right now, for me, I'm just in a place where I'm sort of learning to accept, understand. You know, I've done quite a lot of that journey over the last few years, where I'm at, what I've done. You know, I still fuck up all the time. I still have, you know, my certain demons and inflictions. But I feel I'm a lot more conscious about the positive things. Rather, I think that I spent a lot of time dealing with the negative things.
Just focusing on those.
Yeah.
Things. Yeah.
And it became quite detrimental to me mentally and health wise and emotionally. But equally, I still, through that, I met a whole other world. And so now what's the interesting thing is now for me is that, you know, when I started working with Queens of Stone Age, everybody's like, I don't understand from my world.
Yeah,
you know, but then when I did Science Fiction, everybody was like, "I don't understand." Or I did Never Neverland, like, oh, "It's an electronic record." I don't understand. Queens, I don't understand. Now, you know, making toys, I don't understand. Supreme, I don't understand. Da da da. Whatever. Obviously, your friend, you know, certain people did, but the overall sort of the industry, the world that you were sort of putting it out to, didn't. And what's mad now is that if I hadn't taken those journeys,
yeah, of course,
you know, I wouldn't be where I am now. And I, you know, I had my biggest ever record with Queens of the Stone Age, and then now Queens of the Stone Age made a record with Mark Ronson.
Yeah.
And, you know, I go out and I see, you know, I remember when I met Josh, it was just me, Josh, Clemency and Martina Topley Bird and a couple of other people. And now you go out and it's the XX and it's Florence and the Machine and Donna, and they're all, you know, in that the sort of Queen's world, and you're like,
yeah,
wow, look. So it's all what I'm trying to say is all the dots suddenly kind of connected, and I suppose I feel a little bit more like, oh, okay, actually, however that journey was, and through the loss and the highs and the lows, it made sense, and it makes sense for me now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You know,
yeah. How did you get into that whole the whole kind of, because at that point it was still very much like, I guess, like the Desert Sessions kind of crew,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, with Chris and yeah, and with Josh and with the other guys, yeah, and now with well, and with Geordie as well.
Yeah.
But how did
Geordie was a bit out of that. Geordie was Geordie had a relationship with Chris Goss.
Yeah.
So what happened was at the tail end of Never Neverland, it was the excess of hedonism, Fabric, 12-hour DJ sets, starting at 6 in the morning, finishing at midday, you know. I was burnt out, and I had been introduced to Ian Astbury. And it was funny because Ian, I didn't grow up on those records, and you know, The Cult, The Cure, those types of bands. You know, we liked the Goths because if you'd ran out of Puff or something and you needed some acid, you'd go and see them in Oxford or whatever. But we were the hip-hop acid house kids, you know,
yeah,
and that tribal thing. I heard the records, but they weren't, you know, it wasn't a big inspiration for me as a teenager, in that elitist teenager period. Somebody had asked me to meet Ian for a while, and I was like, I don't know. And eventually, you know, he's like, come, no, just go and have a drink and meet Ian. And I went and met him, and, you know, he was head to toe in Bathing Ape and his amazing presence.
Yeah.
But in that sort of rock and roll LA look. And I was like, and we sat down and we just got on really well. And I wasn't in the best place. And he was sober and, you know, and been through hell and back, real. I mean, you know, I've not been to the places that certain people have been. I haven't been well, I think it's all relative, let's say. But he'd been through hell and back, and, you know, he was just became this sort of enlightened character that I met, that we then decided. He was like, look, come to LA, I've got this idea. I'd met Josh by then, and I'd, you know, I'd sort of worked with him on Never Neverland, and we'd become pretty tight. But Ian was like, you really need to meet Chris Goss. I think that Chris will change your life. He's the most beautiful man. He's like a Buddha type of character, you know. And he is kind of both physically and mentally. And I was like, you know what? I wanted to start making another record. I was really into the Queens of Stone Age rhythms, and I wanted to do something that kind of took my world with that kind of that style of drumming. And you know, he'd produced Rated R, and I also, because he'd done Masters of Reality, which I discovered, I didn't realise, but he was the first rock band signed to Def Jam, and had worked with Rick Rubin, yeah, and his best friends were the Dust Brothers, who did Paul's Boutique, yeah, and you know, Delicious Vinyl, Young MC. And so when I met him, I was a bit like, I don't know, I'll just go and meet this guy in LA, see what happens. Met him in a hotel. And he just started talking about Larry Levan and disco and early hip hop and being in the studio with, you know, the Duff Brothers and all that, and I'm like, what? This is the guy that does Queens. This is the guy that kind of invented desert rock, you know. And, you know, but he wasn't from LA, he'd been from New York. So he'd done dance, he'd done, you know, all the classic New York clubs from the 70s, you know, and but was also really into, you know, he'd also, you know, with Masters of Reality, he worked with Ginger Baker, and, you know, he was, you know, what, you know, obsessed with the Beatles and da 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 da. And I just sat there and I was like, oh my God, you know, like, again, you know, we came from these tribal environments, but actually it's not the individual that's creating what you know. A lot of the individual, you might be into records that people don't think you are. The press would paint a picture of the divide, but actually, you know, I was into Queens and da da da, and he's into disco and hip hop, you know, and it became this amazing love affair. And we went in the studio. I said, let's try something out. So I flew back. Me and Rich went back out, and he said, well, the thing is, I'm working with this guy Twiggy, who wrote The Beautiful People with Manson. And I was like, he's like, do you mind if we do a session together? And I was like, okay. He's like, just sit down and listen to this record, because I'd never listened to that record in a technical way. I just heard it on the radio on MTV. I'd seen it on MTV.
Antichrist Superstar is an amazing album.
Yeah, and I just suddenly was like, it was like, I got, when you listen to production, it's like unbelievable, you know. And that was also my sort of more introduction to Trent Reznor's production and stuff, which, you know, it's phenomenal. And I just was like, you know what, I'm going with the flow here, you know. And we got Ian Asprey. It was me, Ian Asprey, Twiggy, this amazing drummer called Johnny, I think. I've forgotten this a while ago, it sounds bad, but I think it was Johnny. And Goss, me and Rich, and we went and we did Burn My Shadow. And that was the beginning of that, going into that world. And then I went back to London, finished off the end of a load of touring or stuff that I had to do, got even more burnt out, and I was like, Goss is like, are you going to make a record with me or not? And I'm like, I'm packing my bags now, I'm coming to LA, I'm coming for 3 months. And went to Rancho in the desert, and that's how I met Dave Catching and BOC, who played a lot with Eagles Death Metal. Josh was going through pretty mad time when he was doing, you know, just pre-era Vulgaris. But amazing, you know, got him into a couple of sessions, so that's where, like, Restless came from, and Chemistry. And, you know, I ended up singing my first song, and that was a big deal, because Goss was like, you know, man, you know, I was in the studio, and we were in Rancho, and we're messing around. It's a house, so there's loads of rooms, like a house, like a sort of bungalow-style desert house, and, you know, the kitchen's a live room, and, you know, the living room's the desk, and then you've got the bedrooms. Everywhere is a room to record in. And I was pissing around with this engineer that we'd hired in the back, and just with Dave Catching, and just started singing this song. And Chris just walked in, and he's like, "Stop, stop, stop!" I was like, "What?" He goes, "Got to record this song." I'm like, "He's like, it's your record, man. It's your thing. It doesn't matter what anybody thinks. Yeah. It doesn't matter how old you think you are." You know, I was at my, you know, probably, I was about 31, I think. He's like, you have to do this, because it's about you growing as an artist. He's like, it's all fucking theatre, man. It's opera. This is what making records is. Like, stop trying to be so fucking cool and let go. And that was the beginning of a whole new journey in my life, you know, and that relationship with those guys. And I think all of us were going through big changes in our lives. A lot of that was nocturnal stuff, and coming to getting, you know, kind of reaching the plateau of how high you can go and how far you can fall emotionally. And there was just this amazing synergy with everybody. We had, you know, the beginning of it was the how high you can go, and the end of it for like me, BOC, Goss, I think Josh, you know, Josh ended up getting married then, Twiggy, it was literally like, okay, you know, we've gone pretty high here now, like, we're all changing. And most of those guys are older than me, so that was it created these very strong relationships, because you'd gone through quite a journey together. And I also think that from me coming out there, they it wasn't expected. It wasn't, you know, now it's like, you know, everybody goes on about the Arctic Monkeys being the first ones to go to Toronto. They weren't, you know, like people. The person I think was most interesting is Martina out of Tricky.
Yeah.
Because she was way with those guys before anybody.
Yeah, because I remember going to see when Josh was over with Caius. And
do you know Clemency? Clemency and Martina would hang out, and they'd be, and they'd be like,
there would
sort
be
of,
there'd be Sylvia, Lee Hare,
Martina,
and they would go to Caius, and they, you know, they knew Josh, and they knew Hutch,
and Josh always, because we were talking about the other day, because I saw Josh the other day and went to Clemency, and Clemency was like, yeah, because they just thought, oh my god, there's a bunch of girls in the gig at the front, and there's a black girl in the gig, what the hell is this? So they just suddenly stroke up, you know, that's where they got their relationship, and Josh would give them tickets, and that's how they met that whole world, you know. But they were there very early on, right at the beginning, really, and I, but then, because it was weird for me, because I'd pretty much, I'd signed Tricky to Mowax, and then he walked off and went to Ireland. And so I was going to put out the record with Martina, but I never met Martina when she did Tricky. I met Martina with Clemency and Josh, which was really strange. But for me, she's like, what the hell are you doing here? I'm like, what the hell are you doing here? And that was the sort of end of when I was meeting those guys, it was the end of Rated R, the beginning of Songs of the Deaf. So my first show that I went to was, did you go to the LA 2 show with Dave Grohl? That's how I met him. And I basically had, me and Rich had heard A Lost Art of Keeping a Secret on the radio, Radio 1. You know, and sometimes, you know, just a record pops up and you're like, what is that? I really like that. So I went to HMV, bought the album, came back to Old Street, put it on, and we sat there, and it comes on with Feel Good Hit of the Summer. And we were like, oh my god, this is amazing. Let's bootleg it now. And we did a remix that night.
And I
heard through a friend of mine that Queens were doing this show, and I burnt a CD, and I'd never met them, went to the show, and we're like, just, you know, it's like a rock crowd, nobody there. It's, you know, this is really before there was any, there's no A&R guys, there's nobody celebrity, nothing. It was just like proper, you know, rock crowd. And I'm about to leave. I'm like, I don't know how to meet him. I don't know, whatever. I've got the CD. And I get his tap on the shoulder. Hey, James. I'm like, Brian Molko from Placebo. He's like, what are you doing here? I'm like, what are you doing here? He's like, oh, we, you know, Queen's toured with us recently. Do you want to meet them? And I was like, yep. And I met Josh and Lanigan. And Lanigan was, again, this is funny, because Lanigan was a massive Mowax Uncle Massive Attack fan, you know. And so when Brian's like, just leave me 5 minutes, I'll go and see if they want to meet you, whatever. I'm like, they ain't going to give a fuck about us. And they're like, so they're like, yeah, come back. Yeah, like, we love Uncle, da, 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 da. I was like, oh, I did this remix. And they're like, yeah, we're off to Glastonbury. We're playing Glastonbury. And I'm like, they're like, oh, we'll listen to it. And then I put my telephone number on it. And the next day I get this, hey, man, it's Josh. Yeah, 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 I love the remix. We played it at Glastonbury. He's like, let's go for dinner. And then we went for dinner, and that's how it all started. And you know, and then this journey, and I ending up sort of, for me, on the last album, doing Like Clockwork. And, you know, but having these weird parallels. So this new album, having this real, this world of what I'd been involved with here and grown up with here. And then this sort of thing that happened in LA, and these worlds colliding, and sort of going back to what we're talking about originally, sort of how now it's all woven into one.
Yeah, all fused together.
You know, yeah.
It's an interesting one, like, because obviously you're an amazing curator and collaborative artist. Do you know when you hear other people's work that, aside from having like, oh, it'd be great to work with this person, do you know who you're going to be able to? What I'm trying to say is, making music and art is a magical thing, right? I believe.
No, it is. Absolutely.
I think, you know, if you can affect somebody on an emotional level and change their thought pattern, and from just them seeing
just
something
to have,
or hearing
just to
something,
change one person's life in something positive, even if they say they hate it but they want to change it, it's an amazing thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, it goes both ways, you know. Yes.
How do you... Are you literally just going, oh, I'm just going to... As you said, just I'm going to randomly hit this person up. But do you know that there's going to be those connections?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes it'll be random. But the journey only works if that journey is together. And yeah. you just, it's a question you get asked a lot. It's like, how do you meet these people? It's like, how do you meet your friends?
Yeah.
I don't know. You just, you connect.
But do you feel like almost as if you're, and this sounds really hippie, but do you feel almost as if that those things are, you were meant to meet this
yeah,
person?
Yeah, I think that most of the really key moments in what you do, and it doesn't work out all the time, are spiritual journeys.
Yeah.
And, you know, Josh talks very wonderfully in the documentary, very funny, and he's one of the things that I love about the documentary. And he's just, you know, he's talking about that journey and how we were there for each other at a time when you needed to be there, you needed to have that kind of relationship, yeah. you know. And some of those relationships happen at a period of time, and they exist in that period of time.
Yeah.
And some of those things go on for, that's the journey you have through life, you know. And but it's... you know, I've worked with a lot of people that I haven't continued to have relationships with, yeah. not for anything negative, you know, but most of the stuff that I've done that really has been at the core of what I've done are relationships that have been tested over the period of time. That's why I get a little bit annoyed at the documentary about them saying that it doesn't, because actually, you know, I've worked with Josh for 16 years now, you know. Mm. You know, and Goss and Asprey and people for longer, but I think that it is also just this thing of, it's an emotional thing. I mean, you're going to gravitate towards each other because of the art that you create. Okay,
yeah,
that's the first thing. If you haven't met somebody before, you know, I can hear a record and go, this is what music does. You're going, that's talking to me. I feel that, and also because I make records where I'm not the predominant lyricist on a record, you're trying to get a singer to represent how you feel.
Yeah.
It's a weird, strange thing.
Yeah, interpret, you know, things tonally and ideas.
You know, like science fiction, those songs, they're like the songs that I wanted, if, you know, that's what I wanted to be able to say in a weird way. It's a strange thing, you know, and so you are working with people that are saying things or believe in the way that you believe in stuff, you know, and that is about what they're talking about, what their emotional connections are, and those the journeys that really stick are those journeys with the people that you really connect on that level, you know. Yeah. And it's way more than just music. It's about what you are as a human being, you yeah. know, and how you then channel that through music or video or art. Yeah. It's not just about music with what I like to do, you know.
Yeah,
you know,
course.
This 7-year journey between records has also been about me rediscover, you know, meeting and creating a whole new artistic, when I talk about artistic, maybe more in the painting,
visual
arts world, you know. And this, you know, from meeting people like Jonas Berger, who's doing the front cover, and John Isaacs and David Nicholson and Doug Foster, that has been part of it as well, you know. And for me, I think that community is really important. You know, a lot of people ask me, I did an exhibition in Leeds recently, and there was a graffiti artist and a toy maker, and they're like, how do we do it? And I'm like, the most fundamental thing I can say is you've got to build a community.
Yeah.
You all share and collaborate in your work and create your own identity. Can't guarantee it, but hopefully things will grow. That's, to me, how things grow.
Yeah,
you know, we're in a very, very isolated world in the way that community works right now, I think.
It's funny, isn't it? Because you would think on the surface of it, we're in a better situation than ever before.
Yeah, but it's not.
But it just seems like everybody's so fragmented in the sense that it's
too worried about everything. There's not enough time. There's too much negativity. Social media, I mean, it's... I've had my share, but even I saw today Ed Sheeran's Turner's Twig, you know, just looking at my news feed, but it's not in my world, but you think, God, you know, what it must be like when you have, I don't know, 10 million followers on an account to wake up every day and see, I deal with it with my kid, you know, my 20-year-old daughter. They're so concerned about every daily part of their image, you know, everything. You know, if I take a picture of her, she'll get really annoyed because she's got to make sure it's the only picture you keep is the one she likes, you know, because if somebody else sees it, you know, it's like and we spend hours going through all these processes. I don't actually do social media. We have social media with what we do as projects and connecting with information, But I've never done Facebook. I've never done that stuff. And that's partly because I've just, I don't know, I've got a little bit of a lazy old school attitude about, I just didn't get my head into it at the time. And now I've actually never done it. And actually so many of my contemporaries, but actually a lot of the young kids that I work with now are sort of disengaging themselves from that type of social media. Because, you know, one of my Ben Drury's son was at college, and he's like, he came to stay with me recently. Ben's my designer, and his son's a great photographer. And I'm like, oh, you don't have an iPhone? He's like, yeah, I got rid of a smartphone. I'm like, why? He's like, because I can't do any work. Because every time, all I see is pictures of everything I want to do, and I can't feel like I can do anything on my that's individual, you know. And then you think about, you know, I did about 200 records of Moax before the internet, you know, and I've never done that since.
Yeah.
So there's something weird. I mean, they do say since the sort of industrial revolution, like productivity has gone down, not human creative productivity has gone down, not up. I think that, like you say, yeah, it should be just this amazing world and amazing way of connecting with people. But we seem, unfortunately, as humans, to not make it better for ourselves, you know.
Yeah, there's too much distraction. Like, yeah. This is another thing. I think when you're working, when you're working in a visual sense, or when you're working and creating in a musical sense, do you find that you only have so much focus? Because as somebody that makes visual art and I make music as well, I don't know whether it's just because I have an obsessive personality in the sense that if I started painting again, it's almost like blinkers come on.
Yeah, I go through. I'm sort of half and half.
Yeah.
I'm very obsessive, and I can be very dysfunctional about anything practical.
Hmm.
But I seemingly from the career that I've had, I think maybe it's my comfort zone. I don't know if I'm at my best, because I would love to just be able to stop sometimes and just focus on one thing. But it seems like when I've got a lot going on is when I'm at my best. But it isn't necessarily always the best quality of life, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
You know, and it hasn't always brought me the most, you know. I'm not very good at always focusing at one thing. Mm. And maybe if I just done an Uncle or just done Moax or given myself that time.
Mm.
Time is a, you know, retrospective is a great thing, but
yeah.
But things might have been different. You know, I look at somebody like Richard Russell, who I work with on Excel, and, you know, it was building Excel, then building the new generation, and now I'm going to go and do my career. The thing is, when I started, I was so young, you couldn't even think about getting to that point.
Yeah.
It was only about tomorrow, you know, or that day, you know.
Of course, yeah.
You couldn't see about, you know, somebody say the record won't be out in 6 months. You'd be like, what? 6 months?
That's an age
that's
away.
That's like,
yeah.
Way, miles, years away from me, you know.
Funny,
so I think I'm trying to get better at that. But I go through waves of, you know, I go up, very up and down, and but when I'm up, I love to collaborate, and so when I'm in an environment where I feel that I'm working with people that just really excite me, and that can be from really across the board situations, I adore it. I'm enjoying doing this interview, and I, you know, it's great to be able to talk like this, you know, and so this is exciting. Whereas if I'm doing, you know, but if I'm sort of going through the same old thing constantly, that's when I get stuck.
Yeah, you start to switch off on things. I'm the same. I totally get that.
But I'm not very good at being on my own, and I'm not very good at sort of just constantly and necessarily immersing myself just on my own into something. I do it with certain things, or like if I get, you know, you have those moments where it's like, okay, I've got to put a collection of records together or something, and you just get in that zone. Yeah, I can do that. But I'm very easily distracted, and I think I'm used to being easily distracted, you know, because I was running a record label, I had, you know, you're doing all these different things, and I still, you know, I'm not a typical musician, I'm not a typical anything, and I don't mean that in any sort of like, wow, I'm amazing way, I mean it in like, I'm good at putting lots of things together, and maybe not good at doing the simple focus things, you know.
Do you find when you're working on things, whether it is on a more visual level or whether it's more art, well, I think for me, it doesn't seem like there is so much distinction for you, because everything seems quite seamless. Like, a lot of the music is so cinematic, and I mean that in the best way. I don't mean that to sound like...
No.
But, I mean, for example, with the album that's coming out, there's, what is it, 30-page booklet that's coming with it?
Yeah.
And it just seems like everything runs hand in hand.
But to me, it's not trying to be like I'm not trying to make something where I'm trying to be like over the top. It's just that it doesn't exist to me if those things don't exist together.
Yeah,
I don't want to put a record out with a front cover and that's it. It doesn't make sense to me.
Hmm.
To me, it was about building universes. And record labels and great bands. You know, I was constantly, I used to remember getting so criticised for the idea of how, when I was doing my works, of these sort of ideas that one had. But I was like, this sort of idea of, it's music, visuals and fashion and da-da-da, that's so cheesy. It's like, well, wait a minute, all the great things to me were, whether it was hip-hop, whether you look back, and any movement, any creative movement, there was a movement, and it was never just about...
No, it was a microcosm of all these things.
Things, And it wasn't just about, just the painter or just the musician. Hip-hop was about the dancers, the clothes, the politics, the music, the sampling, the records, everything,
Yeah.
And I don't think that's dissimilar in any movement, whether it's rock and roll, whether it's being a goth, whether it's being into acid house, And I feel that, for me, identity and creative identity and working in that way is essential to what I do. And the basis of it is music, but out of that comes video, photographs, artwork, and to me, every great record has that identity.
Hmm.
And that, whether it's Blue Lines to Sgt. Pepper to, Queens of the Stone Age, as examples, whether it's the Beastie Boys, Def Jam, Warp...
Yeah.
Blue Note, whatever, the list goes on. James Brown, whatever. They created worlds.
Yeah.
And when you bought their records, you bought their world. And those worlds were, hip hop records. It was incredibly important to buy the album and read the credits, because you read the thank yous and you'd think, oh, well, who's going to come next?
Hmm.
Who are they hanging out with?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
And, exactly. I know, exactly
all
what
that
you
stuff.
Mean. I found so many great artists through that.
Yeah. And I think that's something that gets lost now, because I think, unfortunately, with digital media, there are great positive sides of it, but the downside of it is that you go on Apple or you go on Spotify, you don't know who's done a cover, who's recorded it, who's engineered it, who's produced it, who's played on it, nothing, really. Everybody is collaborators, unless you are the one genius musician that does everything, and there's not many of those.
Yeah,
but not really.
Well, Prince died, so
yeah. And equally, they also make a lot of crap when they're like that at times. Not to say that I haven't as well. I've made a lot, but I mean it in the sense that you can't. It's like you build a house. You do need a plumber a lot of the time. You do need something to lay the floor or lay the foundation or build the roof most of the time. And I think music and art is like that. It's not just about the one individual. It's about the culture that goes around it. And I want to show that world with what I'm doing. I love that. I this 7-year period, like I said, has been about putting all that together, whether it's the collaborators on the record, whether it's from both the past and the present and the future, to the artists that are creating all the visual elements, to the people that you perform with, the teams of people that you work with that help you release the record. Everything is about that community. And what is really exciting for me now is that it's like I've got, great relationships from the past, but there's this whole new world of new people or new relationships that have worked from the last sort of 7 years onwards, that it's really exciting to feel like, I feel actually like I'm back to the beginning. And I feel a little bit like, for the first time in a long, long time, it feels like the energy that I had when I was doing my wax, in that way, working with people like Elliot Power and Mink and Keaton Henson and an Esker, and then you've got the relationships in America, or you've got somebody like Lanigan, and putting that all together and having that energy where there's the sort of OG energy, and then there's this young And I'm learning, you know. And I think that in your life, you can go through periods of, you know, the beginning was all naive and learning and everything's new. And then you go for your kind of like, I know everything, fuck off period. And then you suddenly sit there and go, oh, wow. You know, where am I going? I'm 43. I feel like there's so many things in my life I haven't done. Where am I going to be in 10 years time? What am I going to take, the lessons I'm going to learn? And I need to be inspired. I need to learn again, you know, because it's all changed. Yeah. 7 years, it's kind of, I look at it as the Facebook period. And since that to now, you're like, it's all changed. So putting this record out is, you know, I'm thinking, oh, you can do this and that. That's how it works. It's like, it ain't like that anymore. You know, so I'm learning a lot, but with this great bunch of people that I work with, especially these younger kids that I'm working with, you know, like George, who's co-designed the record with me, you know, they're sort of 24, 25, 26 years old, and they grew up with them, they discovered my records, whether it is Elliot's mum used to go to Bar Rumba, you know, yeah. Or, you know, George going to design, you know, going to art school, but being into street art, and they, you know, suddenly this group of kids are like, they know more about me than I do, you know, cool. But they also see it in their way, and it's about sort of engaging in that way, and this sort of new community, and for me, that's what it's always been about. It's about this, about community. So when, you know, one of the reasons I didn't do, you know, a new record for a long time is I didn't feel I had a community anymore. That community had ended. And I needed to re-find, you know, build a new commune, you know, creative commune.
Amazing. That's a great point.
Cool.
Awesome. Thanks, man.
No, pleasure. Really great. Thank you.
Cool. Thanks for checking out episode 19 of Someone Who Isn't Me. Cheers to James Lavelle for an amazing afternoon. It was, like I've said it before, the thing I love about doing this podcast is that I get to sit and have conversations with people whose work I really respect and admire, and it's just wicked to hang out and do that, and I hope you all enjoy listening to them as well. We had a great afternoon hanging. As I said, just to be surrounded by all these incredible pieces of art was super inspiring as well. It's wonderful now that we're kind of texting each other about artists that I think he should check out and maybe would work to collaborate with, and putting people in contact with him. That's super exciting as well and really gratifying. So yeah, so thanks to him. Also thanks to Emma for sorting this one out again. If you could leave a review if you enjoyed the episode, 5 stars is a beautiful thing. Do that on iTunes. Spread the word. Let everyone know. Remember, the new Uncle album, The Road Part 1, comes out August 18th on Songs for the Deaf. It's a great record and it's going to be very beautifully packaged as well, so it's well worth checking out. The documentary, The Man from Moax, is... I'm not actually sure when it's coming out, but it was a good watch, if a little bleak at times, as we discussed. But thank you once again.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Glad you came and checked out this episode. Peace.